yourself a song to sing and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. They brought death to our hometown, boys. Death to our hometown, boys. Death to our...
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, let's do our normal week in review. What's happening globally and in the U.S. economically? And I also want to end up here talking about the big news of the week, and that, in my opinion, is the ECB, European Central Bank, one-upping the Japanese central bank that occurred last month when Japan went with negative interest rates, increasingly desperate moves on by the central banks. And in terms of monetary policy, they're really rolling the dice now because they're running out of ammunition. And what they're doing is loading their guns with blanks. Well, actually, they may not be blanks. They may be bad ammunition, and when they pull that trigger, it may blow up in their face. Well, we'll see. This is a very interesting global experiment going on. I predict a lot of negative fallout from all this. But we want to talk about the European Central Bank on Thursday, yesterday, really even one-upped the Japanese, continuing the dueling QEs between Japan and Europe as both get desperate as their economies slink in and out of recession and as they grow more desperate on both sides of the globe here as the global economy itself slows. Anyway, we'll get to that as our last item of discussion. But what I want to do first here is give a review of the week, because a lot of interesting things have happened. First of all, oil prices. Oh, they're back up to $40. They were below 30 here. Now they're back up to 40. What's going on with global oil prices? Well, is it supply? Have they really cut the supply of oil that, you know, would raise the price? Nope. Supply is growing. What about demand? Is demand picked up? Nope. Demand continues to slowly decline. Well, wait a minute. You know, mainstream economic theory says if you increase demand, the price will go up, but there's no demand increase. And it says if you reduce the supply, the price will go up, but there's no supply reduction. So what is going on? Well, what's going on is that it's pretty much proof that oil prices are driven by speculators, by the spot market, and by purchasing commodities, oil commodities, future contracts. That's what's driving this. You know, the global shadow bankers are buying and selling this stuff on every little rise and dip. And they took as their excuse to buy more this time, this so-called rumor of the Saudis and the Russians somehow agreeing to cut their supplies or something. There's no agreement to that effect. There's some far-fetched talk, but no agreement. Oh, but they use it as an excuse, you know, to go in and drive the market up, drive the market down, because, you know, they make money on volatility. They make money when the price goes up and the price goes down. They love it to be volatile. All these speculators love volatility. They like the thing to collapse as much as to rise. They may, as long as it keeps bouncing up and down, you see, they just don't like it to go in one direction for too long. So they manipulate the market, drive it up or down. That's like the U.S. stock market, you know, back up to well over 17,000, almost at the 18,000 peak again. Well, what's driving that? Is it the average stock buyer? No. 75% of all the U.S. stock buying of the Dow is made by institutionals. They call them institutionals. They're shadow banks, okay? Shadow banks and their investors who are driving the global economy more and more and more, as I pointed out in great detail and analysis in my book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, Chapter 11 and 12, Restructuring of the Global Financial System. and the shift to financial asset investing. Why is that going on? Well, that was, you know, chapters 11, 12 in my book. And then, of course, the big theory critique of mainstream economic theory, why it doesn't pick this up. And even Marxist theory, why they still keep focusing on real production and not on the financial side of the global economy, because global capitalism has become financialized. And classical Marxist theory does not give an opportunity to analyze. They just call it fetish capital and disregard it and keep focusing on real production. Well, real production, real investment is declining because more and more money capital is flowing into even more profitable financial and asset investing. Well, that's the book. You know, go to my blog, jackrasmus.com. You can click on the book, get it at a discount, a 20% discount, less than you'd get it at Amazon, okay? So that's the point I want to make about this oil price surge, which, of course, since it's a financial asset now, since the Commodities Futures Act of 1999 that you know, Bill Clinton so generously gave us, well, what he gave us was a shafting, and what he gave the oil companies and financial speculators was a great boon in that. But ever since then, crude oil is really a financial asset, not just a physical commodity. In fact, its role as a financial asset is far more important. You see, as the price of oil goes up and down, so does the stock market, which just means they're all just financial assets, see? Okay, so that's my take on the recent temporary blurb move up here in global oil prices, right? Long term, it's not going to hold, of course. The other global event here, Japan. Japan, fourth quarter GDP, in recession again. In recession. You know, second quarter of last year, 2015, it entered recession. And then the third quarter of 2015, it indicated a recession. Oh, but then quickly, within a week, Japan doctored up the numbers and got from a negative 0.8 GDP decline in third quarter, we get a 1.1 rise in GDP. And that was almost a 2-point GDP correction, unprecedented to correct GDP by 2 points within 1 week, you know. Of course, it was all doctored up. But more and more pressure by companies to play games with their GDP, which isn't the great indicator anyway. But that's the one that gets all the news, you see. And that's the one that all these countries are playing games. I've commented at length about that, and we'll continue. Of course, we're looking forward to the U.S. First quarter GDP and what that will be here early in May. But we'll address that later. Okay, so fifth recession since 2008, Japan. And Japan has been desperately trying to boost its economy with monetary policy, liquidity injections by its central bank. And, of course, the prime way it's been doing that, as all the global capitalist economies have been doing, focusing on monetary policy primarily and virtually excluding fiscal policy, government spending, and tax cuts for consumers, in other words. QE, monetary policy injection, central bank liquidity injection. And the goal of liquidity injection is to boost the stock markets and to drive down the value of their currency. Boosting the stock markets, where you pump all this liquidity into the economy, and the shadow bankers and big investors and banks borrow it, and they go and invest in stock instead of invest and loan to real companies to really expand their production that would hire people and generate wage incomes and generate consumption and GDP. That way, instead of doing that, right? What do the bankers do? They loan to their shadow banker investor buddies, and they all buy stocks and bonds and foreign exchange and other derivatives and so forth. That's what they're doing with all this QE. That's what they did in the U.S. with all the QE, and the U.K. with their QE. And now since 2013, we got this big dueling going on with Johnny-come-lately's European Central Bank and the Bank of Japan with their dueling QEs as they try to one-up each other by driving down the value of their currencies. You see, money liquidity injections end up with buying currencies to drive down the value of it. It's a form of monetary devaluation. You know, it did the same thing during the Depression years, 30s, but then it was a devaluation by government fiat, you see. Now they devalue by pumping liquidity into the economy and drive down the currency rate, which makes their countries or regions' exports more competitive vis-a-vis their competitors. You know, so Japan and we got this global decline going slowly, steadily in the global economy. We are virtually zero here, almost in terms of global trade volumes. First time that's ever happened. We have an industrial, that was a manufacturing global recession already. The only thing holding everything up is services and phony ways of calculating GDP. So the whole idea of monetary injections here and dueling QEs, Japan and Europe, who are at the lead of this, is to drive down their currencies so that they can get a bigger share of a shrinking global trade volume. You know, they're beggaring their neighbors. If they can get a bigger share of global exports, you know, they hope that that will stimulate their domestic economies and get growth going. So, in other words, the only way you get growth going now in 21st century capitalism is to pump money into the rich and the speculators in the hope that somehow that will trickle down into the real economy. See, it used to be just trickle down for workers, but now it's trickle down from financial to non-financial sector. And the whole idea of money injections, QE, drive down the currency rate, stimulate exports that hopefully, desperately, might lead to some increase in real investment in jobs, you see. But when everybody's playing that game and everybody can, it's just a race to the bottom. Japan, anticipating that Europe would make this announcement yesterday, Japan last month, you know, expanded its QE here. Another way you expand QE is, you know, through negative rates, which forces banks not to keep their liquidity in the central bank, because it's going to cost them money to do so. Presumably, logically, they will then loan it out. Well, that's not happening. You know, they'll sit on it, the banks, if they can't get a minimal safe interest in the central bank by putting their cash there. They'll sit on it instead of loaning it out, or they'll wait until they can loan it out to some speculator. And that's what's been happening in Japan. You know, the QE since 2013, in which they're buying, they started buying corporate bonds as well as government bonds, hasn't had any effect on the real economy. And we've seen this seesaw, the yen, the currency declines and they get a little advantage, and then somebody else cuts theirs and they lose that advantage, and et cetera. And in the end, all they're doing is boosting more and more liquidity into the global economy that feeds more and more speculation in various financial asset markets. But they keep doing that. The logical hope is that if they pump the money in, the rich will get wealthier and wealthier from their stock and bond price profitability and gains. And the logic is, well, you know, they'll get so wealthy, they'll want to invest in real things, and that will generate the economy. Again, a kind of financial trickle-down is what QEs and monetary policy is all about, and all the global capitalist economies are, have been, and continue to engage in some form of monetary policy only, to the exclusion of fiscal stimulus. particularly stimulus that would cut taxes for consumers or government spending that would benefit average households. You know, if they went that route, it would be bailout and let the average household and consumer recover first and hopefully buy more goods, and in buying more goods, generate more profitability for the business sector, particularly the real business sector, you see. But the capitalists have decided in the 21st century they don't want to go that route anymore. In other words, bail out Main Street, stimulate the economy, and therefore stimulate profits. What they're doing is stimulating profits first, particularly financial profits. You see, the problem is financial speculation and all these financial assets and so forth, average people don't invest in them. So putting money in the hands of average people, average households, you know, they're going to go out and buy real things, and the real economy might recover, but the financial asset markets wouldn't recover very much. And right now, the financial sector has a stranglehold on the political systems and the central banks, and therefore, the whole policy focus is pump all this liquidity and money and profits into us, and maybe we'll dribble down a little bit. In other words, just the opposite, you see, just the opposite of how it used to be done, stimulate Main Street and get the economy going. Because everything's so financialized now, and because the financial elite have a stranglehold on the politics, it's been inverted. It's only policy, monetary policy only, which takes zero interest rates or QEs or negative interest rates or, you know, all these different forms of boosting the financial side and hopes that it dribbles down to the rest. Well, that's what financialization is about, you see. And it's not simply a question that so many other left writers have attempted to say, oh, financialization is an increasing share of profits out of total profits or increasing employment in the financial sector. That's so narrow a definition that it's insufficient, you see. It's not a question of the FIRE sector, finance, investment, real estate. That, I mean, 25% of all multinational corporate profits at minimum are from financial speculation. So they are banks too. You know, the multinationals are banks, even though they're not officially considered a bank. Yes, they're banks. A quarter of all their investments are financial assets, derivatives, and so on and so forth. And then we have this huge shadow banking sector, globally growing. You know, where more asset values now, investable assets sit on their balance sheets than in the regular commercial banks, who are hybrids anyway. You know, they're part shadow banks and they're part not. So all this talk about the regular banking system, you know, that's just a small picture of the financial sector. It's this whole structural change and the new finance capital elite globally of couple hundred thousand of them, and all their liquid financial asset markets and all their new securities and everything, they're the ones who are driving the whole capitalist system in the 21st century. You know, and until we start really looking at that and understanding that phenomenon as a global structural change, that structural change is what financialization is. It's not a share of profits, simply. You know, it's all these new liquid markets, it's all these new institutions, shadow bank and quasi-shadow bank and embedded shadow bank institutions I talk about in my book, right? And it's all their new securities. That's what financialization is. It's finance capital running the show like never before. Ah, but mainstream economists, they don't look at the financial side. And financial economists, they still believe this fairy tale about efficient markets. You know, I mean, it's such a nonsense, right? As if you have competition and efficient markets on the financial side. So you can cross them out. They have no idea what's going on. And then you have the mainstream economists who are not who are never trained in financial variables, who simply, you know, look at GDP and all the real variables, and that's all they can do. And all their models are based upon that. They don't understand what the hell's going on. The Minskians kind of got a sense of what's going on. And there's a small grouping of Marxists, you know, in Europe who are beginning to understand what's going on. But the mainstream of the Marxists are still looking at productive value from productive labor and falling rate of profit from producing things, fixed capital, etc. And anything that's financial, well, that's on the other side of the circuit of reproduction of the capital. And we're just going to call that fetish capital, and we're not going to pay any attention to that. Okay, that's my railing against against those mainstream and other views of trying to understand financialization and what's going on. Well, you know, we see the policies of financialization in Japan here. The significant thing about Japan is that their QE program was the first to break out and start buying corporate bonds, not just government bonds, you see. They're buying corporate bonds, and I think they're even buying stocks. They're testing that over there. I'm not sure, though. I could be wrong about that. What you see is the capitalist state, the central bank of the capitalist state, which is still effectively, its policies are determined by the banking system, the financial system, I should say, playing a bigger role in bailing out the financial system. A constant bailout, a constant role. You see, they didn't just bail out these banks back then in 2008-9. They're still bailing them out, and they're still playing a bigger and bigger role. If it wasn't for this state, the capitalist state, buying all of these bonds and buying all of these securities constantly since 2008, we would be in a depression that was deeper than the 1930s. No doubt, there is a de facto depression that continues, except for the liquidity and the buying, which is of bonds and financial assets, which is recovered the financial side, recovered the top end of the corporate capitalist system here. And it looks like, therefore, there has been a recovery. But the recovery has not extended down at all to Main Street. Not at all. And that's why, by the way, in the U.S. version of this, people are so pissed off. You know, you can see it, you know, people going for Trump, going for Sanders, huge amounts, and the elites in Washington, the two wings of the corporate party of America called Democrats and Republicans, they're perplexed. They don't know what's driving this. Well, they're starting now last week or so to begin to get a little sense, and you see it in their writings, that they're awakening to the fact that class politics are back. They're taking a form of electoral politics. It's not independent class politics yet, but that's coming. Right? It's electoral expression of a class that has no organization of its own, but gets to express its discontent through the electoral system. And that's what's going on now. That's what's appealing about Trump. You know, Trump's policies, I don't believe a word he says, but his policies are really pro, in some ways, pro-working class. He's a kind of distorted reflection of Reagan running in 1980, where Reagan absorbed the white working class discontent, the Republican working class, they called it then. You know, those of us who were around can see the connections there. He's appealing to that. Of course, he's not quite the same. You know, he's more aggressive and more outrageous. You know, building walls to keep immigrants out. You know, what a dumb thing, building a wall. You can't keep people out with a wall. What, you think people can't drill under the wall? I mean, what are all the drug dealers bringing their stuff? You know, they're not walking across the desert. They're going underground. And you don't think that they're going to build more underground tunnels and bring people through that way? Of course they are. And what, people, you're going to build a wall across a river? People just go around the wall and go up the river. I mean, it's so ridiculous. But you see, these politicians tell us what they think we want to hear, and then they go and do what the hell they want anyway when they're elected. And that's true of Trump. You know, he's got all this outrageous stuff. He's appealing to the really deep discontent of the working class in this country. He's appealing to that, and so is Sanders. So is Sanders in a more honest way, right? And, you know, the establishment Republicans running, you know, are just so perplexed. They don't know what's going on. And if they're catching on now, it's too late for them. And Hillary is desperately trying to, you know, move left to, at least in the nominating, she'll go back to the center and the right and the establishment views once she gets the nomination. But, you know, she's saying things and telling us things just so she doesn't get outflanked. Because she got outflanked by Obama back in 2008, you see. Obama and even John Edwards, 2008. She got caught off guard and got outflanked. And, of course, Obama talked left. And then as soon as he was elected, he moved, you know, deeply to the right, appointing Larry Summers and all these bankers that run his show. And he's been Mr. Minimal ever since. And that's going to be Hillary's big problem. How is Hillary going to overcome this working class discontent if she's nominated? And all that youth and working class and even minority support for Sanders, if she's nominated, it's going to disappear. She's not going to get it back. And that's going to be a big problem for her in the national election, right? And that's Obama's number one legacy. That's her albatross, her Obama albatross hanging around her neck. The youth and workers are going to be so disaffected from the Democratic Party, they will not turn out to vote. That low vote turnout is her biggest danger, no matter what she says, because people just don't believe the establishment parties anymore. Doesn't matter what they say. This is a negative vote against the establishment, and you're going to see that in November, both left and right. We have a left populism and a right populism emerging here because neither of the two wings of the corporate party of America are acceptable to people anymore. After 8 years, since 2008, of no growth for them, yes, growth for the top. Right? That's why, according to Emmanuel Saez, professor of economics at UC Berkeley, right, his studies of IRS data show that since 2009, since Obama came in office, 97% of all the net income gains have gone to the 1%. That is the main issue. That is the issue. 97% of all the income gains. Under Bush, it was 65%. Under Clinton, it was 45%. And under Reagan, it was 39%. So we've seen this huge increase going on, getting worse, 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 going to the wealthiest 1%. The wealthiest 1%, by the way, make their billions and millions from financial speculation. It's not just income equality being driven by wages for the median family income falling 1% to 2% a year, which is what's happened. Yes, wages have stagnated and declined, and that's why the working class is so pissed off. Right. But the big inequality, because inequality is a percentage. It's a relationship between wage incomes versus capital incomes. And it's the capital incomes that have escalated far faster than even the wage incomes have stagnated and declined. So you get this big gap. You see, there's two causes, two ends for income inequality. But if you listen to the liberal economists, you know, people like Reich and Krugman and Stiglitz, yeah, they're focusing on the wage side, and that's good, but they're not focusing on the financial side of why this is occurring enough, because they don't really understand the financial side. Okay, so, you know, the working class is pissed off, and we're going to see that even clearer. I'm going to be writing about this on my blog, jackrasmus.com, more and more here. For articles I write as well for Telesur, South American media, twice a month here. I've been focusing on the election. So, you know, I'll be writing about what are some of the scenarios we can expect once Sanders gets squeezed out and Hillary's the nominee, which is going to happen, and once Trump, who has already beaten his opponents, comes on board here, and what happens should the Republican establishment try to block Trump, which they may try to do. There's a strong wing in the Republican establishment to try to prevent him from getting nomination, even though he has the primary votes. We'll see how that turns out. And, of course, the nominating convention is going to be very interesting as well, because Sanders isn't going to get it. And even if he got it, the Democrats would do the same to him, you see. This is the early stages of the breakup of the two wings of the capitalist party system ruling this country for decades now. Early stages, we'll see what happens here. It's going to take another decade, maybe, but we can already see the seeds of that beginning to happen. Okay, so back to Japan, Abenomics, of course, a disaster. Abenomics means liquidity injections and to boost stock prices, lower currency exchange rates, and austerity and tax increases for the rest of the populace. That's what it is. And it's getting even diminishing returns now on boosting stock prices and reducing currency rates. You know, even its primary objective, QE primary objective, is becoming less and less effective, particularly in Japan and Europe. Okay, another interesting development here globally. The Government Accounting Office says it's going to investigate the Fed. About time. You know, they talk about central bank, Fed, Federal Reserve independence from the politicians. Well, the issue is Fed independence from the bankers, and it's always been that. From the time that the Fed was created in 1913, it's always been a question of the bankers running the show. Back then, they ran it even more, you see. Little by little, over time, every time there's a crisis, people wake to the fact that the central bank is really in the pocket of the banks. And they take away a little of the authority of it, and this time is no different, people are beginning to realize. By the way, I am writing another book under contract here for Clarity Press, which will appear later in the year, called Central Banks on the Ropes. Well, I'll be looking at the Federal Reserve and the Bank of Japan, Bank of England, and the European Central Bank, and the fact that their policies have declining effective impact, even on their primary goal, boosting capital incomes, declining. So what's going to happen when it has no effect and people realize it? You know, what are they going to pull out of their bag of policy tricks, right? Will it be fiscal stimulus? Not according to the bankers. They don't want that, right? I'll also be talking about this to some extent, this central bank phenomenon, in my forthcoming book in May called Looting Greece, The Emergence of a New Financial Imperialism by Clarity Press. You can go to Clarity or go to my blog and even go to Amazon, I think, and you'll find some. At least you find a book jacket photo and I think a table of contents. I'm not sure. Clarity Press will have a table of contents. But I'll be looking particularly at the European Central Bank because the crisis in Europe, the stagnation, is really a function of its 1999 decision to create a currency union, the euro, and at the same time, the European Central Bank. That has led directly to the crisis of debt in the euro periphery, the worst example of which is Greece, and how now we have, when I say emerging new financial imperialism, what I mean is that instead of exploiting workers paying low wages in the colonies, producing textiles or something like that, classical imperialism, right? Or 20th century U.S. imperialism, where multinational U.S. companies go and plop themselves down in these colonies, let the local elite run the political system as long as they let them, the multinationals, make their profits, which are then partly sent back to the U.S. and partly hoarded offshore, i.e. true global companies. You know, that's 20th century U.S. version of imperialism. But now we got a new kind of imperialism emerging, and that is based on debt and interest payments. In debt these countries and require them to continually engage in austerity in order to make their interest payments, and it's the interest payments that flow back to you know, the financial sectors in the global capitalist economy. It's even less difficult to identify, you see, and because there are no foreigners exploiting the workers directly at production. But they're making the workers and everybody work like hell to produce the surplus that gets sent back as interest. It's a financial imperialism. It's a new form of imperialism. I'll talk about that in this book, Looting Greece, coming out in May. And, of course, in my Systemic Fragility book, I spent a lot of time, chapter 14 in particular, looking at central banks and growing financial instability and fragility as a result of central bank debt. Because the central banks are taking more and more, they're offloading all this debt that's being created in the private sector by all this liquidity. It creates all this debt, and the debt sort of clogs up the system. You know, it's kind of like cholesterol in the arteries of the global capitalist economy, so they got to clean it out periodically, and they take all this gunk and they put it on their own central bank balance sheets. See, that's what the role of the central banks is now. But then, you know, it clogs up again, and they got to, that's why it's continual. They're continuing siphoning off the worst debt and piling it all on their central bank balance sheets. The state is keeping the system going. Okay, so if you want to see some of my views, you know, on central banks, which I think is centrally important, no pun intended, you know, chapter 14 of my existing book, Systemic Fragility and Global Economy, just out this past January, extended, very long section, about 15,000 words there, and just in that particular chapter. And I'll be focusing on that specifically in relationship to the ECB, European Central Bank, and the Looting Greece book coming out, but and then I'll just attack that whole issue on a general global level here with the book due out in the fall, Central Banks on the Ropes. All right, still talking about financial matters here. An interesting piece of news came out this past week where Natalia Jaresko, who is the economic minister U.S. In Ukraine, a U.S. Citizen and a former CEO of Horizon Capital, private equity firm, right? When the crisis erupted in Ukraine, its economy collapsed. Well, it was always half collapsed anyway since 2005. But when it really collapsed in 2014 and all the military and political upheaval with the U.S. coup there, that occurred in early 2014. The economy collapsed. The IMF went in and couldn't bail things out. So the IMF had to up its bailout. And, of course, the EC, European Commission, and others had to join in the bailout. And as part of the bailout to ensure that there would be austerity, the EU and the U.S. Had their puppet Petroshenko, the president there, or prime minister, I don't know what he is, of Ukraine, appoint these two ministers, Western capitalists here. The U.S. Capitalist Natalia Jaresko was given the portfolio of economics minister, and of course she was made a Ukrainian citizen overnight by decree, and the EU got to appoint the economics minister. One was the finance minister, one was the economics. His name was Abramovicius here, a hedge funder associated with Germany. I think he was a Latvian, but associated with Germany or Lithuanian. Anyway, German hedge fund player. He was given one of the portfolios there. Between them, Jaresko and Abramovicius were running the economy, but the economy keeps deteriorating, you see. the EU and the Western capitals just can't root out the corruption there. So this is also a form of the new imperialism emerging. In other words, as these capitalist countries and bankers pile more and more money into these countries to bail them out and to set up the condition for the interest rate backflows, they also engage in deeper political control, direct political control. You know, I mean, like in Greece today, you got every Greek minister, and even down to the local level, you've got a EU, a troika, as they call it, a European Commission troika person sitting at their elbow with veto power. Oh, you can't do this because then, you know, you won't be able to pay your austerity bill. Oh, you can't do that. Oh, make sure you sell off this or that public entity here so you can pay your bill. So it's kind of like de facto veto power. And emissaries, I call them troika commissars, who are invading and sitting at the elbow of every elected official in Greece here, making sure that the austerity and the interest rate flows continue as the Greeks get deeper and deeper in debt. Well, the same thing, there's a political component, in other words, of this new imperialism, and the same thing is happening in the Ukraine, with Jurescu and Abramovicius appointed, but even that's not enough. And now Jurescu is going to run for office. Yeah. I think she's running for prime minister, something like that. I just read it. I have to look at that again. But in other words, even more direct control of the whole process. Abramovicius, he dropped out. He got so frustrated with the corruption there that he just said, "I'm gone." So Jurescu now, the U.S. is, it's an indication the U.S. is deepening its political influence and control over Ukraine, and Petroshenko is going to be even more of a puppet. And then of course you got all the crazy proto-fascists there running around beating up on each other. So it's a real basket case, but Jurescu, you know, is the equivalent of U.S. Satrap in Ukraine. What's a satrap? Well, that's from the old Persian Empire, where they had these outlying governors running all these provinces. They were like little kings themselves, and they got to do whatever they wanted to do, as long as they ensured that the taxes were rolled back to the Persian capital here in ancient Persia here in 500 B.C. or whatever, right? They were satraps, we call them. Well, you know, Jurescu is going to be the new U.S. satrap in the Ukraine. Let's talk about another issue here, and that is China's latest umpteenth mini-stimulus. Umpteenth, right. Ever since China's economy began to slow in 2012-13, China has, and the speculators and financial bubbles grew and grew. China has been engaged in trying to slow down the bubbles, and they've done that by slowing down the economy, which has slowed down the general growth rate. When that happens, they reverse course and they try to get the economy going back again. So China for 3 or 4 years now has been in this up and down effort to tame the shadow bankers and the speculators, because we got financial bubbles bubbling and popping all the time in China now. You know, in between that, they engage in these mini fiscal stimulus, right? But the big problem is China has been boosting its liquidity, you know, incredibly every year. Last year, another 14% increase in money supply and liquidity. And that's what feeds the bubbles, you see. They tried to deal with the property bubble a few years ago by redirecting the money into the stock market. Well, it worked, but it created a stock market bubble. And then that bust. And now, from what I can tell, is they're redirecting the money out of the stock market into property markets, and that's creating another property bubble. You know, it's whack-a-mole bubbles over there in China. But they'd rather create a property bubble and keep the money within China than continually feed this massive capital flight out of China that's occurring. about $1 trillion last year. And at the same time, that money's flowing out, so they're pumping 14% into the economy, and a lot of it's flowing out, including money cashed out from the stock market collapse, and that money's flowing out. And they're trying to stop that somehow. That's one of the big problems over there. At the same time, they got a problem with collapse of their old line industries, steel and coal and so forth, which are so indebted that it's a big problem. They've got to get rid of some of that debt for those old line companies. And they're trying to sell off the debt. They're trying to swap it for stock. They're not getting that much takers on it. They're now engaging, from latest indications, of a big cost cutting in those old line industries, including last week a layoff of 1.8 million steel workers and coal miners. 1.8 million declared will be laid off, and wage cuts for the rest. Whoa, that's going to warrant watching. See what the Chinese workers are going to do. They're a pretty militant bunch when they do it. Of course, there's a lot of oppression and control of independent action, but when you're desperate, people take desperate moves. All right, so China's trying to deal with prevent currency devaluation, prevent its capital flight, prevent the $25 trillion corporate debt that is accumulated on their balance sheets over there. Trying to prevent a rapid collapse of its stock market, But all of a sudden, we get this mini stimulus, and the stock markets around the world say, "Oh, great! China's recovering," and the stock markets go up. Right? In fact, globally, we see this little surge in the stock markets. The U.S. stocks are still over 17,000. The Dow back up. Why? Because of the QE in the Eurozone. Because of the dead cat bounce here in oil prices, because China's mini stimulus and Japan's negative rates. All that boosts the stock prices. So that's why we're getting this stock thing. But it's going to be very temporary, right? We're not going to see it for much longer. The other important development here in France, Holland, the president, the ersatz socialist, France is taking a big risk, and Holland government's taking a big risk in pushing for labor market reforms. At the beginning of this show, I talked about driving down exchange rates with QE monetary policy, right? To try to continue growing by exports. You see, the big problem in Europe is they're trying this export-driven growth. That's that German influence, Germany, all export-driven growth here. And so all Europe is trying to drive export-driven growth. Well, where does labor market reforms come in? Well, this is what's called internal devaluations, which is a supplement to QE currency devaluations. What is internal devaluations? Reduce the wage cost. Just as QE reduces your exchange rate cost, attacking wages and pensions and labor cost is internal devaluation. That was lower the cost of the production of your goods. You get an advantage in price in competing in global export markets. That's a growing focus, has been for several years now in Europe. And we saw that was at the heart of this Greek debt crisis. They could not, the Troika could not allow Greece to continue not cutting wages and jobs and pensions, because that would be an example to everywhere else in Europe. You could go ahead and do that too. So that's why the Troika was willing to go to any lengths to prevent any kind of reform in Greece. Would not allow Greece to grow out of it. And that was one of the big policy and naive mistakes made by Syriza, to think that they could get the more liberal elements within Europe to side with them for a different approach and allow them at least some relief when it comes to cutting wages and jobs and pensions and so forth. Nope. That was never going to happen. Anyway, that's the idea with that more in my book, Loot in Greece. But the internal devaluations in France now, what's the latest big move here? We got massive demonstrations going across France right now, and that is to cut the 35-hour work week and reduce costs. And the socialist minister, Manuel Valls, here is leading the charge. Yeah. Well, last year, 90% of all the jobs created in France were contingent jobs, part-time temp jobs. Yeah, 90%, almost all. You know, and in the U.S., it's a far larger number than the reporting as well. This is what capitalists are doing as a kind of a threat to the policymakers. You know, we're going to make your life uncomfortable. We're going to, not grow wages. We're going to save money here by creating temp jobs, contingent jobs, instead of full-time jobs. You see, in France, their labor laws protect full-time employees. Very hard to lay off a full-time employee. But if you're a part-time employee, they can give you the axe real easy. Well, this labor market reform thing is not only to cut the, to increase the work hours, but also to allow more layoffs, easier layoffs by French businesses, right? Not just temps, but full-time. And eliminate the fines and the access to court to defend against layoffs. See, that's what this labor market reform in its current form over there in France is about. And, you know, the justification they're trying to provide is that, hey, look, you know, we got to take away some of the rights of full-time workers because all these employers are only hiring part-timers in order to avoid hiring full-time workers. So in other words, let's reduce everybody's rights. Instead of saying, the socialists, instead of saying, well, we got to give the same rights to part-time temp workers as full-time workers, and then there will be no incentive for employers to hire part-time temp workers. Instead of doing that, which makes a lot of sense if you're a socialist, right, they're doing the opposite. They say, well, you know, we got to take away the rights of the full-time workers, and therefore that will discourage them, employers in France, from hiring part-timers. It's just the opposite, you see. Opposite of what they should be doing. But very interesting, isn't it, how socialists and social democrats respond. And that's why social democracy and social democrats are disappearing everywhere. You know, and neoliberal policies are taking over everywhere. Okay, so one last thing on Europe here, the ECB, European Central Bank. Draghi, as I said at the beginning of the show, indicated that we're expanding our QE. Well, how are they expanding it? In the following ways. One, negative interest rates, which already exist on government bonds, are being driven into more negative territory. Instead of a previous 0.3% negative rate, now it's a negative 0.4%. Okay, a minor token reduction in negative rates. But the big thing here in this latest move on Thursday by the ECB is that now they're going to start purchasing bonds, corporate bonds, not just government bonds, but corporate bonds. And there was bailout to corporations by buying their bonds. And increasing the total amount of bond buying from about $66 billion a month, which is what QE was before Thursday, to $88 billion a month. So a $20 billion increase, most of which, or a good part of which, are going to be corporate bond purchases. It's estimated there's about $500 billion in corporate bonds available for the ECB to purchase. And so it's going to start doing that. And the idea is, well, if we back offload the debt from corporations, bonds or debt, right, onto the ECB central bank balance sheet, it will free up more space there, monetary space in corporations to invest. Well, you see, all of this is predicated on a false economic analysis that says if you reduce borrowing costs for corporations, either by lowering interest rates or just reducing costs in general, could be tax cuts, whatever, that all that additional free money is going to necessarily be invested in real production. No, You see, that's what's wrong with neoclassical economics. It says that. But what can just as reasonably happen is a couple of things. One, they can sit on the extra cash, corporations, that they now have because of the lower costs. They can hoard it, in other words. Or they can invest in financial speculation, which is much more profitable for them, right? Or they can invest abroad. That's what's happening with all this QE and monetary injection, you know. It's not benefiting the home country and region. It's flowing out. And this is the logic behind buying corporate bonds, you know. And the question in Europe is, whose bonds are you going to buy? Which corporations? German corporations who really don't need it? Yeah, probably most of that, right? Which countries? Whose bonds and what countries are you going to buy? Now, whose bonds and what corporation in what countries are you going to buy? But the result short term is we got a recovery of the stock markets going on in Europe. And instead of the euro collapsing, as it was, it's stabilizing, right, a little bit for a while. But there's big risks here, you know, in Europe. We got continuing deflation. You got continuing stagnation in the real economy. You got 10% plus unemployment, right? And now you're buying corporate bonds, right, to bail out corporations. And you got negative rates, you know, trying to force banks to invest instead of plopping the money down in the central bank, which they aren't. They're going to sit on it. All right? And the negative rates, by the way, raise their costs, so that's going to probably reduce their lending. And then you got, if you're buying up all these bonds, corporate and government bonds, from the general economy, you're going to end up with fewer bonds to trade. So in the general economy, so that when there is a crisis, there's going to be a shortage of bonds, a liquidity crisis in bonds that could very well lead to a greater and faster turndown when the next financial crisis occurs. We got the same thing going on in the U.S., a problem with bond liquidity. You know, we have a problem with junk bonds in the U.S. We have a problem we're going to see once the stock market starts falling again with exchange-traded funds. And we have a problem with what's called the repo market, where bonds are traded between corporations. And there's not going to be enough bonds available for trading when people want to start selling them. And that will exacerbate and accelerate the financial asset collapse in bonds when it happens, you see. So the ECB is setting itself up for greater trouble here, as are all central banks who are engaging in corporate bond buying. We see that in Japan. They led the way, of course. Well, what can they do next? Well, Mario Draghi says this is the, quote, last salvo, unquote. So he's boxed himself in the corner now. He's saying, I can't do any more if this doesn't do it, which it won't. But they can always just extend it, you see. That's how they will increase it, extend it. They may not sweeten the pot even further, although they may, just like the Japanese buying stocks, central bank buying stocks. Anyway, that's the review of the world here, and particularly this latest ECB decision, which is really significant. And we'll see how this plays out. Next week, we're going to talk about the U.S. elections, scenarios for post-nominating conventions. Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.